Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, debt counsellors under scrutiny as moves are made to clean up the industry. Simplicity, self-expression and science-backed wellness lead 2026 consumer trends. A seven-year study reveals what sets South African entrepreneurs apart, and are year-end bonuses a right or a privilege? It's Friday, the 7th of November. The National Debt Counselling Association says it wants to raise the bar for debt counsellors, introducing what it terms fit and proper standards, as well as new oversight rules to protect consumers and clean up the industry. Now, we know we have a huge debt problem in this country, so raising this red flag, I imagine, raises some concern as far as broad protocols go. I want to talk about this in a little more detail with Rene Munsami, who's chairperson of the association. Rene, a very warm welcome to you. This is worrying. What has prompted the crackdown? How bad is the problem of rogue counselors?
Yeah, you know, there was a time that the credit industry was also not as regulated as it is today, and lending was an extremely profitable business. And because of the lack of proper legislation, especially around things like interest rates at the time, a lot of consumers were exploited and had, well, no protection. And back in 2002, the DCI set up a credit review committee to review the policies and legislation that we had. And out of that initiative, we got the National Credit Act. We're seeing the exact same pattern now in debt counseling. And unprotected consumers are being exploited and they're being put into further financial distress. So our members have submitted this proposal to DCIC. We want to raise the bar for professionalism in the industry because we believe that the time is now and the review is necessary. And we want to ensure that only qualified ethical counselors are allowed to practice, and that the industry has the same standards expected in the broader financial services sector.
Rene, when you talk about exploitation, how exactly is that manifesting?
Well, you'll see a lot of rogue ads, social media, YouTube. You might see flyers up promising clients things like clearing their credit bureau history, clearing their ITC statuses, removing a blacklisting flag on their credit reports, all of which is an impossibility, and it is conning consumers out of the debt counseling process, which is a legitimate legal way in which a consumer can reduce their monthly installments, renegotiate things like their interest rates and the terms on the finances, and luring them out of that to pay these rogue debt counselors or entities large sums of money to quote unquote exit them from a debt review process. But that exit is not a possibility. That's not the way a consumer should go through the natural cycle of debt counseling and come out on the other end being financially viable.
It's really upsetting and a sign, I guess, of desperation as far as debt in this country is concerned, which we all know in many respects is out of control.
Definitely. We're seeing more and more consumers falling for those scams as we head toward the festive period. A lot of consumers are cash strapped, and that's the truth. And the idea of clearing your ITC report is attractive for someone who's trying to access further finance. You know, if you don't have a good credit bureau scoring or listings, then you're not going to be qualified for good debt from a good lender, a bank or a reputable firm that will offer you reasonable rates and reasonable terms of repayment.
So these new fit and proper standards that you want to introduce, what would they entail? And how do they change the paradigm in terms of who can practice and who can't?
Well, it will mean that becoming a debt counselor, you will need stronger qualifications. You'll need practical training under supervision and ongoing assessments of competence. It will also mean that debt counselors must run proper, governed, financially stable practices. They'll have to be skilled, ethical, operational, and in the same way that you would expect of other professionals in the financial sector, it needs to be ethically and professionally sound, not just a license given to a debt counselor on paper.
How soon could these proposals actually be adopted into law?
Well, we've already shared the proposal with the DTIC, we've shared with the National Credit Regulator and other industry stakeholders. The next step for us is going to be collaborative engagement and regulatory drafting, which is not a short process. But we're hopeful because the elements of that proposal that we have included, we're hoping it shows up in the amendments to the National Credit Act that is already in discussions now. You know, as always, legislation can't be done overnight, but momentum is strong, I believe, from all the industry stakeholders. And I think the entire industry is ready for a higher standard. The members in our own association have already adopted a lot of what we have proposed to the DTIC, and we're hoping our stance, together with the rest of the industry players, lifts everyone up and we push it forward as quickly as we can.
Renee, no one's doubting your good intentions, but even if you have the law in place, surely it's going to be very difficult to police and regulate.
Absolutely. Like in any industry, you're always going to have unscrupulous players that try to use or bend the law to suit their own agendas. But as an industry, we need to focus on consumer education. That's why conversations like this are so important. We need to bring the topic up to everyone's ear to allow the consumer to make the best possible choice for themselves. You know, when you're seeking out an attorney or an accountant or a financial advisor, you're going to want to look for someone who is legitimate and well-established. And I think the same is going to be applicable for consumers when they do seek out, if they ever need it, debt counseling. And we need to give them the education and the option to do so and to choose someone that is ethical.
Your intention is to improve trust, but the obvious question is, will tougher rules raise the cost of debt counseling?
It may do so. There are already conversations in play with industry stakeholders on how we structure the debt counseling fee system to suit both the consumer, the debt counselor, the credit provider, and any other players involved. Ultimately, debt counseling is always going to be tailored to suit the consumer's specific financial situation. And I believe that tighter regulation will actually improve the ability for consumer to access debt review rather than make the barriers higher for the consumer, which is not what anyone in the debt review industry would want.
While the process of change or recalibration is happening, what then would be your message to consumers who are unsure right now where to turn to for legitimate help?
That's a great question. I think I'm going to go back to my statement about when you're seeking out professional advice. When you're looking for an insurance representative, a financial advisor, you wouldn't go to someone who doesn't have a long-established reputation, someone who does not appear to be legitimate. I would say if it's too good to be true, the offer that you are being proposed, it usually is. And I would suggest that consumers seek out information about debt review, not just the fuff that we see on online, on social media and other platforms when you first search for it. But, you know, if you're really invested in seeking out an attorney, you're going to do the work to look for one that you believe will have the best interests of the consumer at heart. I suggest we do the same. Members of associations are a great call and first point of call for us because we will hold each other to a higher standard of professionalism, which is really important. So my advice is don't be afraid. If you need advice, seek the advice of a registered debt counselor, especially one that is a part of an association.
Thank you very much indeed. Renee Monsamy, chairperson of the National Debt Counseling Association. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this is interesting. The way we live, shop, and even care for ourselves is changing fast. No real surprise there, but some interesting facts are starting to emerge. Euromonitor International's Top Global Consumer Trends 2026 report says tomorrow's consumers want calm in a noisy world. They want radical authenticity and also science-backed wellness. Well, I want to get to grips with that. I'm in conversation now with Christy Tawib, who is Regional Insight Manager for Africa and Middle East at Euromonitor. Christy, a very warm welcome to you. I like this one, calm in a noisy world. What does that mean and why?
I think we can say that if we look at where we are right now as a, you know, as a society, comfort zone, should I say, the comfort zone trend is one of the most relevant trends right now, because consumer everywhere are actually feeling stretched. So based on our voice of the consumer survey, you can see that more than half of people globally say that they experience moderate to extreme stress every day. So on top of that, we've got rising living costs, we've got job uncertainty, we've got the constant digital overload, and all of this is what I would say is adding on to the protection mode. So people are looking for calm and control in, should I say, in this very unpredictable world. So there's also this social pressure to do more, to optimize or to keep up with technology, which creates what I often decide as perpetual overwhelm, right? So that's why right now consumers are redefining value. They are not just chasing what's new, but they're looking for products that genuinely deliver ease and reassurance. So that means that for companies, there's a need to design something that with simplicity in mind. So products should be easy to use with clear instruction. There should be minimal effort. So, and I think if we look at our region, this very much resonates because we are balancing a lot of daily financial pressures in. So we really value brands that remove friction. So we're seeing this very much reflecting in various comfort categories. So to put it in a way, comfort and calm is a new luxury. And the brands that help people slow down, simplify, or feel in control, even when the world is not, I think we'll be the ones that we believe that those are the ones that will win based on our report.
And I imagine that most consumers would empathize with that. We would relate to it. I wonder, though, whether brands are moving quickly enough in that direction to meet that new need of consumers.
Yeah, I think we are, because, again, I will draw back to the African stuff. We are a region that is more about affordability, right? So affordability, authenticity, there's a lot that we are seeing that's speaking to this across the region. For example, we're not starting from scratch, especially when you talk about a lot of things. We've got a whole lot of homegrown wellness brands that are already blending things that we know and making it easy to co-create with other products, which makes our lives easy,
I want to come back to wellness in just a moment, but you also use the phrase fiercely unfiltered. You've already referenced authenticity. What does that mean, and how far will consumers go to achieve that?
I would say that this is very important because it captures the shift in how a lot of consumer right now, they how they want to express themselves. I think people are tired of perfection. So they want brands that are relatable and transparent. So again, if you look at our data, more than half of global consumers, they like to be distinct from others. And about two or three of those say that they're comfortable expressing their identity openly, either with friends or family. So authenticity is becoming the kind of social currency. And it's how people decide which brand deserve their loyalty. So drawing it back again to us for businesses, this means that you can't just have a one-size-fits-all marketing. It won't work anymore. I think a lot of people right now can tell when a brand is not genuine. So they expect companies to listen. They expect companies to engage with communities sincerely and to also show consistency in what they say and what they do. I think if I can give you some really good example is that we've seen companies succeed by bringing authenticity into action, where they invited employees from diverse cultural backgrounds to co-create products. And here in Africa is very much relevant because if you look at our young people, they are embracing their local identity and pride. We've seen the rise of, well, how should I call, Afrocentric fashion, music, beauty products that actually celebrate the African narrative.
Yeah.
So it's more than just copying the global templates. And I think, yeah, Africa brands can lead with that cultural truth because we are telling stories that are grounded in who we are and not what's trending elsewhere. Because the moment you imitate or overcompensate, that means you lose credibility. So in essence, authenticity is the new trust mark. Brands will win when they shop to protect, to be, you know, pretend to be perfect, but just be consistent, human, and true to the values.
And just a quick one in conclusion, what do you think is behind the convergence between linking health and technology?
That's a very good question in terms of linking health. And I think right now is that people no longer see health as something that you only manage at the doctor's office, but it's about bringing that clinical level care into our lives. And we're seeing it. I guess we can also, if we just reflect on, there are so many home diagnostic tests or apps that we using just to track our, whether it's a wellness app, supplements, or even fitness wearables, right? I think it's something that we're seeing growing. And in Africa, we're not starting from scratch. Across the continent, we're seeing a lot of wellness brands that are, wellness is a new wealth. What do they say? It links to health is your new wealth, right? So it's not going anywhere. And it's something that we're seeing across industry. Let me give an example, like the tourism industry. Wellness is one of those category where we've seen spending growing. And destinations like South Africa are very much well positioning themselves, or should I say, they're positioning themselves as wellness hubs that combine the nature, the culture, and stuff that people are looking for. So it's not just about new gadgets. It's about consumer giving control in terms of personalization in their health journey.
All right, Christy Tawi, thank you very much indeed. Some fascinating insights there. Regional Insight Manager for Africa and the Middle East at Euromonitor International.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, after 7 years of research, the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation and the University of Pretoria have developed South Africa's first entrepreneurial competency framework, a blueprint for understanding what really drives entrepreneurial action in our very diverse society. It identifies 14 competencies from risk-taking to value creation and argues that diversity, not uniformity, must shape how entrepreneurship is taught. I'm in conversation now with Carl Herrmann, who's head of impact insurance at the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation. Carl, this is very interesting. The study taking 7 years, that's a long time. What was missing from South Africa's entrepreneurial research that made this such a long-term investigation?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. So how I could position it is that the motivation really came from one simple and pressing question. Why, despite so much investment in entrepreneurship education and policy support, do very few South Africans actually start businesses? So at the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation, we've spent nearly two decades developing responsible, high-impact entrepreneurs. But we noticed a very familiar pattern. Many programs focus on theory and technical skills, while a very few of them actually implement actual competencies that translate into knowledge and entrepreneurial action. So together with Professor Melody Boerta and the University of Pretoria, we set out to answer just two questions. Which entrepreneurial competencies truly drive entrepreneurial action? And the second one was, how can we develop and measure them in a South African context? And this basically became the basis for that seven-year longitudinal study.
Now, Carl, you've narrowed hundreds of potential competencies down to 14. Regrettably, I don't have time to work through all of them. But are there one or two that clearly separate entrepreneurial intent from entrepreneurial action?
Yes. So the study really gave us some interesting findings. I think one of the most notable ones was that growth mindset was one of the strongest predictors of actually starting a business. And so one could ask, like, what does this actually mean in practical terms, right? So if we just define what a growth mindset is, it's that belief that one's abilities can be developed through effort, feedback, and learning. So not fixed talent. So in our research, entrepreneurs who demonstrated this growth mindset were basically st- statistically the most likely to start and take action, even in uncertain conditions as well. So in practice, what we see is that with these particular entrepreneurs, they see failure as feedback, not defeat. They persist through adversity. They adapt their strategies when conditions change, and they actively seek opportunities to learn and grow. And I think, like, just to for all aspiring entrepreneurs out there, this is incredibly liberating, because you don't have to be born an entrepreneur. You can now develop this mindset. You can develop these competencies that lead to entrepreneurial success.
It tells me, Carl, that in addition to all of that, you've got to be very brave to be an entrepreneur. It's not just about optimism.
That's correct, yes. Definitely the calculated risk-taking, which is one of the competencies. We found that that was one of the six sort of competencies that were very predictive of entrepreneurial action as well. So having that sort of ability to take calculated risk and to push yourself and, to test yourself in unfamiliar territories is incredibly important for becoming successful.
Did you apply your mind at all to structural barriers? I speak to so many entrepreneurs on this program, and the single biggest issue is access to capital. Do you address that and ways in which entrepreneurs can either succeed or at least navigate their way through those very choppy waters?
Yeah, so at the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation, what we do is we work with the entire entrepreneurial ecosystem. So we've got various stakeholders and partners. We've got sister entities that provide venture capital for these entrepreneurs that we identifying and develop and developing into high impact responsible entrepreneurs. There's obviously lots of entrepreneurship education around funding, how to access that funding. And I suppose the way a lot of the Alan Gray Orbis sort of program participants are privileged in a way is that there is access to capital for them, having gotten to the program and completed and graduated through our pipeline. So there is access, and we do basically kind of educate them around funding issues and barriers to access to that type of funding, yes.
But Carl, beyond your foundation, the question perhaps on a broader canvas, it's the single biggest problem that faces many entrepreneurs. Do you have advice on how they might navigate that problem?
It's a very interesting question. I think one would need to, the venture capital nowadays are just getting less and less with the economic crisis that's happening in the globe at currently. So working together with sort of entrepreneurial incubators is probably one of the best ways to kind of access that sort of funding. And I would say to any aspiring entrepreneur out there, if you're looking for funding, look for entrepreneurial support organizations. They are basically organizations that put you on an incubator or an accelerator program. So it's not only just about funding, but it's about acquiring the mentorship, the business support, the access to markets, including the venture capital that comes with that. So only once you refine that idea and it becomes a very feasible sort of business idea, do venture capitalists start kind of supporting your venture.
Carl, let's get back to the teaching. The study calls for a move away from a one-size-fits-all method. How do you practically embed diversity into that process without fragmenting standards?
Yeah, so South Africa is a country with multiple realities. I think we've got rural, urban, formal, informal, affluent, under-resourced areas. So entrepreneurship education, how we have always experienced it is that it follows a very generic, westernized type of model, assuming that all learners start from the same place. So during our research, we found that that context matters. So entrepreneurial learning must be personalized, and it must be experiential in nature, and it has to acknowledge the different cultural norms, resource levels, and the learning styles of your young entrepreneurs. So a one-size-fits-all curriculum overlooks the ingenuity that already exists in our communities, and this can unintentionally reinforce inequality as well. So by contrast, if you take the South African Entrepreneurial Competency Framework, it allows educators now to customize those learning pathways, ensuring that every aspiring entrepreneur, whether in Khayelitsha or Sandton, can develop these competencies that fit their context.
So let me put you on the spot in a final question then. If I said to you, you have to design South Africa's national entrepreneurship curriculum tomorrow, is there a single insight from your research that you would make non-negotiable?
I would say that all entrepreneurship education programs and initiatives should follow a competency-based approach. It's about developing those soft skills. So it's not necessarily about all the knowledge, education, and so forth, but those soft skills, those behavioral competencies are what sets certain individuals apart when it comes to entrepreneurship.
Fascinating conversation. Carl Hellman, thank you very much indeed. Head of Impact Assurance at the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation. Appreciate your time tonight.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, with year-end fast approaching, many employees are hoping for a festive season bonus, but employment lawyers are warning there is no automatic right to one. So what does the law actually say about bonuses, about discretion and fairness in these tough economic times that all of us are experiencing? I want to talk about that with Khodisho Pashe, who's a senior associate in employment law at the law firm Cliffdecker Hofmeyr. Khodisho, let's start with basics. Welcome to you. Is there any legal obligation on an employer to pay a bonus in this country?
So a short answer to your question is there is no legislation within our country which obliges employers to pay bonuses to its employees. So that's just the short answer in terms of, is there an obligation? However, there are instances where the payment of a bonus is a guaranteed right. And that could be either in terms of an employee's contract of employment, an employer's remuneration or bonus policy, or perhaps even an industry-regulated bargaining council main agreement. So those are what we would have a bonus, which is a guaranteed right if it's agreed beforehand. But as a standard, there's no legislation that obligates employers to pay bonuses.
But if I have a contract or a policy with a company that specifically mentions a bonus, would that make it automatically enforceable?
Yeah, so that's actually a good question. So even in that instance, you still have, two options is the way that I would put it, is that if your contract of employment specifies that you are entitled to, and I'll use an example, a 13th check, and that is the guarantee, then you are guaranteed to get that. However, if the employment contract says the bonus will be subject to and the employer's discretion, so for instance, if it's a performance bonus and not merely a 13th check, then in that regard, the employer still has the discretion whether to grant it or not based on your performance.
I have a funny feeling that the tricky word here is discretion or discretionary. Many bonuses are described as that. What does that mean in legal practice, and where can employers trip up?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. And I'd like to start off by saying this. There is no such thing as unfettered discretion or uncontrolled freedom in terms of how an employer may exercise this discretion that they have. The exercise of discretion must always be subject to being tested against basic tenets of fairness. So that's where our law is. So, and I understand your concern in saying that, you know, employers can be tripped up in this regard, because even that discretion has to be applied fairly. And the CCMAs and our courts have identified that that may be a pitfall or like a point of contention between employers and employees, that they've made provision for employees to refer matters to the CCMA where they feel like that discretion was exercised unfairly.
And does that happen a lot? Do employees challenge a withheld bonus if they believe that discretion wasn't applied fairly?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it does happen quite often, especially, you know, if it's a significant amount and an employee is, in their view, they've met all the requirements and their performance is what is expected by the employee, then yeah, we do get dispute such as those in the CCMA. And what's very important to consider in the CCMA when such claims are arisen is that the onus lies on the employee to state that the discretion was exercised unfairly. So those are some of the things that the CCMA will be looking at.
So let's thread this needle a little further then. What kind of evidence would an employee need to prove unfair treatment in that kind of dispute?
Yeah. So first of all, it would be a matter of what entitles one to such a bonus in the first place. So they'll need to look at that and further then align that with the employee's, I guess, contribution or whether they've met that standard. And obviously, you know, the facts will then be important in that regard, as to say, well, this is the requirement, this is what I met, or my targets, or whatever it is, and based on that, I should be getting this. And obviously, you know, another thing that could be used is whether there's some sort of inconsistent conduct from the side of the employer to say, look, there's employee A and B, and both of them have the same standard, but I was unfairly, I guess, you know, I wasn't considered for this bonus, whereas the other employee who had the same standards and we had the same performance, they received the bonus. So it's a factual, I guess, consideration and a factual conversation.
And Khodisha, is there an argument about precedent? Let's assume a business has been paying bonus for several consecutive years because times have been good. Might that create a legitimate expectation of payment at the end of the year?
So in those instances, the employer's, I guess, remuneration and bonus policies would usually state that the bonus is based on either the business's performance or the employee's performance. And in instances where it states that it's based on the business's performance itself, then the employer has already, I guess, made it clear beforehand that should the business not perform as well as it, you know, expected to, then there shall be no bonuses. And understand, I mean, it could be a contentious thing because, you know, 1 year the business may view that their profits are not as much as they anticipated, and there's usually no, I guess, clear and objective number that they would give you. So that's also one of those things where, again, it's up to their discretion, right? Yeah.
Just a final question, and this is more about maybe process rather than the law, but in this cost of living crisis that we're undergoing right now, there's obviously growing tension between financial prudence and for companies to balance morale at the same time. How should employers manage that process or that communication?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the start is to really be cautious about what is promised beforehand. I think, you know, in as much as employees don't like the word discretion, I think it's helpful, more helpful rather than a guaranteed 13 check or something like that. I mean, again, you could view this from both sides, but the reason I'm saying this is that it really takes into consideration the economy as is when the bonus is required. So should you promise your employees a guaranteed bonus and then your business does not do as well, that may even lead you to consider other things such as retrenchments and the like, which at the end of the day affects more people than you just saying, look, there's no bonus this year. Whereas if you have a guaranteed bonus that needs to be paid out, then your only other alternative as a business would be either to try cut costs somewhere else, which may still have a big impact. So I think there's a very important need to balance those two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Khodisha, do you know if I'm getting a bonus this year?
I seriously hope that you do, because you're doing such a great job. But hey,
well, from your lips to my boss's ears, thank you very much indeed, Khodisha Pasha, Senior Associate in Employment Law at the law firm Cliff Decker Hoffmeyer. I appreciate your time. Thank you. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.